Disc 4.
Xing's mandolin, a high-pitched voice, so distinct it could have been coming from the next room, announced when the phone on the other end was picked up. Filled up at lunch. Same tonight. No fleet table until lunch Sunday. Don't hang up, Martin cried into the phone. So, it's me, Martin. Yin Shi, from where you calling, huh? Martin knew that Fred would be keeping track of his whereabouts through Asher and the Israeli Shabak, so he figured he was not giving anything away if he told the truth. I'm in Israel.
Israel a Jewish kingdom or Israel a Jewish delicatessen on Kingston Avenue?
So didn't wait for an answer.
You know about Min, huh?
That's why I'm calling. Tell me what happened, so. The story spurted out.
She goes up to check the hives the way you asked. She does not come back. Clients begin to fidget. No food in sight. I go out back and shout up, Min! She does not shout back. I climb fire escape, find Min laying on back, not moving, not conscious. Crazy bees stinging life out of Min's face. Disgusting. Makes me want to vomit. Call police on loft phone, Martin. Hope you do not mind. Let them into loft when they ling bell. They put on face masks and chase bees with can of laid found below sink. They take Min away in ambulance. Face bloated big like basketball. She dead before ambulance leech hospital, Martin. Min's death makes page 2 daily news. Big headlines say, deadly bees kill clown ice woman.
What did the police say, so?
Two police detectives come for lunch next day. Sons of bitches leave without paying check. I wave it in faces, but they do not take hint. They ask about you, and I tell them what I know, which is nothing. They tell me ASPCA in white clothing come to kill bees. They tell me hive exploded, which is what made bees crazy to attack Min. Comes as news to me honey can explode.
Through the window, Martin could see the orange streaks of sunset in the sky and the rabbi assembling a group of settlers for the stroll down the road toward Hebron and the cave of Machpelah. It comes as news to me, too, he said very softly.
What you say?
So shouted. I said, honey doesn't normally explode.
Huh. So, detectives, they say Min not even Min's name. She illegal immigrant from Taiwan named Chun Chao. Business pick up when Daily News ran named Xing's mandolin on page 2, even though they spelled Xing Zing. I admit it, whole thing leaves bad taste in my mouth. Very upsetting.
Martin assumed So was referring to Min's death. Yeah, very, he agreed. So, however, seemed to be more concerned with Min's false identity than her death.
Cannot believe anyone anymore these days, huh, Yinxi? Min not Min. Maybe you not Martin.
Maybe the Daily News was right, Martin said. Maybe your real name is So Zing with a Z.
Maybe,
So agreed with a sour laugh.
Who can say?
With Rabbi Ben Zion and Martin strolling along in the lead and the two Kastner sisters bringing up the rear, the group of 30 or so ultra-Orthodox settlers, the men sporting tzitzit and embroidered yarmulkes, the women in ankle-length skirts and long-sleeved blouses and headscarves, made their way down the road toward the cave of Machpelah to greet the Sabbath at the holy site where the patriarch Abraham was said to be buried. Two policemen wearing blue uniforms and blue baseball caps, along with half a dozen of the younger settlers, walked on either side of the group, rifles or Uzis slung over their shoulders. The sun had disappeared behind the hills, and the darkness was starting to blot up the twilight between the buildings. Instinctively, the murky dusk left Martin feeling queasy. Agents who worked the field liked daylight because they could see danger coming, and nighttime because they could hide from it. The penumbra between the two offered none of the advantages of either. The massive fortress-like structure built over the sacred cave loomed ahead like a ship adrift in a fog. "What do the Palestinians here think of your pilgrimages to the shrine?" Martin asked the rabbi, all the while inspecting the spaces between the Palestinian houses off to the right for any telltale sign of activity. Martin tensed as a shard of light ricocheted off a roof. As his eyes grew accustomed to the dimness, he realized it was nothing more than a lingering sliver of sunlight— glinting off the solar heating panels atop a 3-story building. "The Palestinians," the rabbi replied, waving toward the surrounding houses, "say we're walking on their toes." "You are, aren't you?" The rabbi shrugged. "Look, it's not as if we're being unreasonable. Those of us who believe the Lord God gave this land to Abraham and his descendants for eternity are willing to let the Palestinians remain here as long as they accept that the land is ours." "What about the others?" "They can emigrate." Yes, well, that doesn't leave them, or you for that matter, much room for maneuver. It's easy for visitors to come here from the outside and criticize, Mr. Oldham, and then fly back to the safety of their country, their city, their homes. My home, Martin ventured, turns out to be less safe than I thought. He made a mental note to get more details of the death of Stella's father. He wondered if there had been an autopsy.
You're talking about crime in the streets. It's nothing compared to what we have to put up with here.
I was talking about exploding honey. Come again? I must be missing something. Private joke. Eyeing potential danger areas, Martin spotted a spark in an alleyway between two Palestinian homes to his right and uphill from the group of settlers walking toward the cave. Suddenly, flames erupted and a blazing tire, thick black smoke billowing from it, started rolling downhill towards them. As the settlers scattered to get out of its path, the short, hollow cough of a high-powered rifle resounded through the neighborhood, and a spurt of dust materialized in the road immediately ahead of Martin. His old reflexes kicked in. He figured out what was going on in an instant. The tire was the diversion. The rifle shot had come from the other side of the road, probably from the top of the cement cistern 150 yards away on a small rise. The two policemen and the settlers armed with weapons had reacted instinctively and were charging uphill in the direction of the alleyway where the tire had come from. One of the policemen was shouting into a walkie-talkie. Back at Kiryat Arba, a siren, its pitch rising as it whimpered into life, began shrieking across the countryside.
"The shots are coming from behind us!" Martin shouted, and he lunged for cover behind a low stone wall as the second shot nicked the dirt a yard beyond the spot where he'd been standing.
Crouching behind the wall, massaging the muscles in his bad leg, Martin could see Stella and her sister, with her skirt hiked, running back up the hill toward the settlement, which was ablaze with searchlights sweeping the area. Moments later, two Israeli jeeps and an open truck filled with soldiers came roaring down the road from the nearby army base. Leaping from their vehicles, the soldiers, bent low and running, charged the slopes on either side of the road. From behind the cistern came the staccato sound of automatic rifles being fired in short bursts. Martin suspected that the Palestinian rifleman, assuming he was Palestinian, had melted away and the soldiers were shooting at shadows. Dusting the dirt off of his Sabbath suit, the rabbi came up to Martin.
"You okay?" he asked breathlessly.
Martin nodded.
"That was too close for comfort,"
Ben Zion said, his chest heaving with excitement.
"If I didn't know better, I would have thought they were shooting at you, Mr. Oldham."
"Now why would they want to do that?"
Martin asked innocently.
"I'm not even Jewish. I'm just a visitor who will soon go back to the safety of his country, his city, his home."
Benny Sapir listened intently to Martin's account of the incident in Hebron. When he finally broke his silence, it was to pose questions only a professional would think to ask.
"How can you be sure it wasn't some Arab kids letting off steam? That kind of thing happens all the time around Kiryat Arba."
"Because of the diversion, the attack was synchronized. The tire came first. Everybody looked off to the right. The two cops and the armed settlers raced uphill to the right. That's when the first shot was fired. It came from the left."
"How many shots were there?"
"Two."
"And both of them hit the road near you?"
"The shooter's rifle must have been pulling to the left. The first shot hit a yard or so ahead of me, which means he was firing short and left. The shooter must have cranked in a correction to the rear sight and elevated slightly. The second shot was on target. It hit beyond where I'd been standing, which means the bullet would have hit my chest if I hadn't leaped for cover behind the low wall."
"Why didn't he shoot again?"
"Fact that he didn't is what makes me think he was shooting at me. When I disappeared from view behind the low wall, there were still a dozen or so settlers crouching or lying flat on the ground. The searchlights from Kiryat Arba were sweeping the area so he could easily see them. If he was shooting in order to kill Jews, he had plenty of targets available."
"Maybe the lights and the sirens scared him off."
"Soldiers scared him off. But that happened 5, maybe 8 minutes later."
"Beseda, okay. So why would someone want to kill you, Dante?"
"Retirement hasn't dulled your edge, Benny. You're asking the right questions in the right order. Once we figure out the why, we move on to the who." Returning to Jerusalem from Kiryat Arba, Stella had remained behind to be with her sister. Martin had braved the rank stench of a phone booth and had asked information for the phone number of a Benny Sapir. He was given 5 listings under that name. The second one, in a settlement community 13 kilometers outside of Jerusalem, turned out to be the Benny Sapir who had briefed Dante Pippin in Washington before the mission to the Bekaa Valley 8 years before. Benny, normally the Mossad's point man on things Russian, had been covering for a colleague home on sick leave at the time. When he came online now, Benny, who had retired from the Mossad the previous year, sounded winded. He recognized the voice at the other end of the phone immediately.
"The older I get, the harder it is to remember faces and names, but voices I never forget," he said. "Tell you the truth, Dante, never expected our paths to cross again."
Before Martin could say anything, Benny proposed to pick him up in front of the Rashamu restaurant down from the Jewish Shuk on High Shkol Street in half an hour. Exactly on time, a spanking new Skoda pulled up in front of the restaurant, and the driver, a muscular man with the body of a wrestler, honked twice. Benny's hair had gone gray and his once famous smile had turned melancholy since Martin had last seen him, 8 years before, standing at the foot of his hospital bed in Haifa.
"Lots of water's flowed under the bridge since we last saw each other, Dante," Benny said as Martin slid onto the passenger seat.
"You sure it wasn't blood?" Martin shot back, and they both laughed at the absence of humor in the exchange. At the intersection ahead of them, two Israeli soldiers of Ethiopian origin were frisking an Arab boy carrying a tray filled with small porcelain cups of Turkish coffee.
"So you are going by the name of Martin Odom these days," Benny noted, wheeling the car into traffic and heading out of Jerusalem in the direction of Tel Aviv.
The one-time spymaster glanced quickly at the American.
"Sorry about that, Dante, but I was obliged to touch base with the Shabak."
"I would have done the same thing in your shoes." It was obvious Benny felt bad about it.
"Question of guarding one's flanks," he mumbled, apologizing a second time. "The people who run the show these days are a new breed. Cross them and your pension checks start arriving late."
"I understand," Martin said again.
"Be careful what you tell me," Benny warned. "They want me to file a contact report after I've seen you. They're not quite sure what you're doing here."
"Me also, I'm not quite sure what I'm doing here," Martin admitted. "Where are we going, Benny?"
"Haradar. I live there. I invite you for potluck supper. You can sleep over if you need a bed for the night."
"Does Martin Odom have a legend?"
"He's a private detective working out of the Crown Heights section of Brooklyn."
Benny rocked his head from side to side in appreciation.
"Why not? A detective is as good a cover as any and better than most. I've used various legends in my time. My favorite, which was my cover when I was running agents in what used to be called the Soviet Union, was a defrocked English priest living in sin in Istanbul. The sin part was the fun part. To support my cover story, I had to practically memorize the Gospels. Never got over the trauma of reading John. If you're looking for the roots of Christian anti-Semitism, you don't have to go further than the Gospel according to John, which, by the way, wasn't written by the disciple named John. Whoever wrote the text commandeered his name. Now that I think of it, you could make the case that this is an example of an early Christian legend."
Benny turned off the Jerusalem-Tel Aviv highway and was wending his way up through the hills west of Jerusalem toward Har Adar, when Martin asked him if the agents he'd run in the former USSR had been Jewish. Glancing quickly at his companion, Benny said,
"Some were, some weren't."
"What motivated them to work for Israel?"
"Not all of them knew they were working for Israel. We used false flags when we thought it would get results."
"What motivated them? Money? Resentment for personal slights, real or imagined? Boredom?" "Not ideology?"
"There must have been individuals who defected for ideological reasons, but I personally never came across any. The thing they all had in common was they wanted to be treated as human beings, as opposed to cogs in a machine, and they were ready to risk their lives for the handler who understood this. The most remarkable thing about the Soviet Union was that nobody believed in communism, which meant that once you recruited a Russian, he made an outstanding spy, for the simple reason that he'd been raised in a society where everyone, from the Politburo members on down to the inn tourist guides, dissembled in order to survive. When a Russian agreed to spy for you, in a very real sense he'd already been trained to lead two lives."
"You mean three lives, don't you? One where he outwardly conforms to the Soviet system, the second where he despises the system and cuts corners to get ahead within it, the third where he betrays the system and spies for you."
"Three lives it is."
Benny became pensive.
"Which, when you think of it, may be par for the course. When you come right down to it, all men and some women live with an assortment of legends that blur at the edges where they overlap. Some of these IDs fade as we get older,
Others curiously become sharper and we spend more time in them. But that's another story. Consider the possibility that this isn't another story. Is Benny Sapir the last of your legends or the one your parents gave you? Instead of answering, Benny sniffed at the air, which was growing chillier as the car climbed into the hills. Martin kicked himself for having asked. He grasped what professional interrogators took for granted, that each time you posed a question, you revealed what you didn't know. If you weren't careful, the person being interrogated could wind up knowing more about you than you did about him. Benny delicately changed the subject. "Does your leg give you trouble these days?" "I got used to the pain." A grimace appeared on Benny's prizefighter's lips that looked as if they had been in one fight too many. "Yes, pain is like the buzzing in an ear. It's something you learn to live with." As Benny shifted into second and turned onto a narrow road that climbed steeply, the small talk gave way to a comfortable silence that exists between two veteran warriors who have nothing to prove to each other. Benny had the car radio on and tuned to a classical music station. Suddenly, the program was interrupted, and Benny reached to turn up the volume. The announcer delivered a bulletin of news. When the music came back on, Benny lowered the volume. "There was another Picua," he informed Martin. "That's a terrorist attack. Hezbollah in the Lebanon ambushed an army patrol in the security corridor we occupy along the border. Two of our boys were killed, two wounded." He shook his head in disgust. "Hezbollah makes the mistake of thinking that we're all hanging out in Tel Aviv nightclubs or raking in millions in our Israeli Silicon Valley, that prosperity has drained the fight out of us, that we've grown soft and fat and are not willing to die for our country. One of these days we'll have to set them straight." The outburst took Martin by surprise. Not knowing how to respond, he said, "Uh-huh." 25 minutes after picking Martin up near the Shuk, Benny drove into what looked like a rich man's housing project filled with expensive two-story homes set back from the street. "We're a kilometer inside the West Bank here," he noted as he eased the Skoda to the curb in front of a house with a wraparound porch. Martin followed him through the metal gate and along the porch to the back of the house, where Benny pointed out the low clouds in the distance drenched with saffron light. "It's Jerusalem, over the horizon, that's illuminating the clouds," he said. "Beautiful, isn't it?" "No," Martin shot back. The word escaped his lips before he knew what he was going to say. When Benny looked quickly at him, Martin added, "It makes me uneasy." Benny asked, "What makes you uneasy? Cities beyond the horizon? Clouds saturated with light? My living on the Palestinian side of the 67 border?" Martin said, "All of the above." Benny shrugged. "I built this house in 1986, when Haradar was founded," he said. "None of us who came to live here imagined we would ever give this land back to the Palestinians." "Living on the wrong side of the Green Line must be something of an embarrassment for you." Benny punched a code into a tiny number pad fixed on the wall to turn off the alarm. "If and when we agree to the creation of a Palestinian state," he said, "we'll have to adjust the frontier to take into account Israeli communities like this one." He unlocked the door and let himself into the house. The lights came on the instant he crossed the threshold. "Modern gadgets," he'd explained with a snigger. "The alarm, the automated lights are Mossad perks. They supply them to all their senior people." Benny set out a bottle of imported whiskey and two thick kitchen glasses on a low glass table, along with a plastic bowl filled with ice cubes and another with pretzels. They both scraped over chairs and helped themselves to a stiff drink. Martin produced a beady from a tin box. Benny provided a light. "To you and yours," Martin said, exhaling smoke, reaching to clink glasses with the Israeli. "To legends," Benny shot back. "To the day when they become war surplus." "I'll drink to that," Martin declared. Martin glanced around, taking in the framed Hockney prints over the sofa, the brass menorah on the sideboard, the three blown-up photographs, each bordered in black, of young men in army uniforms on the wall over the chimney. Benny noticed him noticing. "The two on the left were childhood friends. They were both killed in action on the Golan, one in 67, the other in 73. The one on the right is our son, Daniel. He was killed in an ambush in the Lebanon a year and a half ago. Roadside bomb hidden in a dead dog blew up as his jeep went past. His mother, my wife, died of grief 5 months later." Now Martin understood the source of the pain that Benny had learned to live with and why he had grown melancholy. "I'm sorry," was all he could think to say. Me also, I'm sorry, was all Benny could trust himself to answer. They both concentrated on their drinks. Finally, Benny broke the silence.
So what brings you to the Holy Land, Dante?
You were the Mossad's Russian expert, Benny. Who the hell is Samatu Gorzhilov?
Why are you interested in him?
He ran off from Kiryat Arba without giving a divorce to his wife. She's religious. Without a divorce, she can't remarry. Her sister, who lives in Brooklyn, hired me to find Samat and get him to give her the divorce.
To know who Samat is, you have to understand where he was coming from.
Benny treated himself to another shot of whiskey.
How much do you know about the disintegration of the Soviet Union?
I know what I read in the newspapers.
That's a beginning. The USSR we knew and loathed imploded in 1991. In the years that followed, the country became what I call a kleptocracy. Its political and economic institutions were infiltrated by organized crime. To get a handle on what happened, you need to understand that it was Russia's criminals, as opposed to its politicians, who dismantled the communist superstructure of the former Soviet Union. And make no mistake about it, the Russian criminals were Neanderthals. In the early stages of the disintegration, when almost everything was up for grabs, the Italian mafia came sniffing around to see if they could get a piece of the action. You will have a better handle on the Russian mafia when you know that the Italians took one look around and went home. The Russians were simply too ruthless for them.
Martin whistled softly. Hard to believe anyone could be more ruthless than the Cosa Nostra.
When the Soviet Union collapsed, Benny went on, thousands of gangs surfaced. In the beginning, they ran the usual rackets. They offered the usual protection.
What the Russians call a roof.
I see you've done your homework. The Russian word for roof is krisha. When two gangs offered their clients krisha, instead of the clients fighting each other if they had differences, the gangs did. The warfare spilled onto the streets in the early 90s. The period is referred to as the Great Moscow Mob Wars. There were something in the neighborhood of 30,000 murders in 1993 alone. Another 30,000 people simply disappeared. The smarter gangsters bought into legitimate businesses. The Russian Ministry of Internal Affairs once estimated that half of all private businesses or state-owned companies and almost all of the banks in the country had links to organized crime. The infamous Zvetan Ugorzhilov, known as the Oligarch since he appeared on the cover of Time, began life as a small-time hoodlum. When he couldn't bribe his way out of one particularly messy muddle, he wound up serving 8 years in a gulag camp. When he finally returned to his native Armenia, Gorbachev was on the scene and the Soviet Union was breaking apart at the seams. Working out of a cramped communal apartment in Yerevan, the capital of Armenia, Ugorzhilov started offering krisha. Soon he was running his own small bank, and his krisha clients were made to understand that they would be smart to use its services. At some point, the oligarch branched out and bought into the used car business in Yerevan. But being a big fish in a small pond didn't satisfy him, so he set his sights on Moscow. He moved to the capital and in a matter of months became the kingpin of the used car business there. I heard all about his cornering the used car market in Moscow. He bought out his competitors. The ones who wouldn't be bought out wound up in the Moscow River wearing cement shoes. The used car racket was the tip of the iceberg. Look, Dante, you put your life on the line for Israel once and I'm going to return the favor. What I'm about to tell you isn't public knowledge. Even the 6th Chief Directorate of the KGB, which was supposed to be keeping tabs on the oligarch, didn't know it. For Zvetan Ugorzhilov, the used car dealerships were merely a stepping stone to bigger and better things. Russia happens to be the world's second largest producer of aluminum. When the Soviet system collapsed, Ugorzhilov branched out into the aluminum business. He somehow raised seed money. I'm talking billions. His used car dealerships were bringing in cash, but not that much. And to this day, it's a mystery where he got the money. And used it to make lucrative deals with smelters. He did all this through a holding company in which he was a silent partner. He bought 300 railroad freight cars and built a port facility in Siberia to offload alumina, the bauxite extract that's the principal ingredient in aluminum. He imported the bauxite tax-free from Australia, processed it at the smelters into aluminum, and exported it tax-free abroad. His profit soared. In the West, aluminum brought $5 a ton profit. In Russia, it brought $200 a ton profit to the people who exported it. By the early 90s, as Yeltsin's privatization swept across the Soviet republics in an attempt to transform Russia into a market economy,
The oligarch presided over a secret empire with the vast profits from aluminum at its base. His holding company expanded into other raw materials, steel, chrome, coal, and eventually bought into factories and businesses by the hundreds. He opened banks to service the empire and launder its profits abroad. Naturally, he kept the skids greased with kickbacks to people in high places. At one point, there were rumors that he'd paid off Yeltsin himself, but we were never able to pin this down. Did the CIA's Soviet division people know about this? We were the ones with assets in Moscow. We shared enough of the take with them to convince them we were sharing all of it. The phone rang. Benny raised it to his ear and listened. Then, as a matter of fact, he is. He's doing what he was doing at Kiryat Arba, trying to pick up the trail of Samat Ugorzhilov so his wife can get a divorce. Actually, I do believe him, yes. Let's not forget that Dante Pippin is one of the good guys. Shalom, shalom. When Benny had hung up, Martin said, thanks for that. If I didn't believe it, you wouldn't be sitting here. Where was I? Okay. A certain number of Russian mafiosi were Jewish. When the mob wars broke out in Moscow in 1993, Israel became a safe haven for some of them. Here they were far away from the day-to-day mayhem. Even some of the gangsters who weren't Jewish came to Israel under our law of return. They concocted new identities claiming a Jewish mother or a Jewish grandmother and slipped into Israel along with the 750,000 Russian Jews who came here in the 90s. As new immigrants, the gangsters were able to bring in large sums of money without anybody asking where it came from. When our Shabak people finally wised up to the danger, we tapped their phones, we infiltrated their entourages, all the time looking for evidence that the Russians were engaged in criminal activities here. But they were careful to keep a low profile. They didn't spit where they ate, as the saying goes. We used to joke that they wouldn't cross an intersection on a yellow light. Using Israeli banks as conduits, they continued their illegal activities, but always abroad. They smuggled uranium yellow cake out of Nigeria and sold it to the highest bidder. They bought into the diamond business, smuggling uncut stones out of Russia to Amsterdam. They could get you a diesel submarine in mint condition for a mere $5.5 million, not counting a crew of Baltic sailors to run it. That was extra. They sold Soviet surplus tanks with or without ammunition, jeeps, half-tracks, portable bridges to cross rivers, anti-aircraft missiles, radars of all sizes and shapes. Payments had to be in U.S. or Swiss currency, deposited in numbered accounts in Geneva. Delivery was guaranteed within 30 days of the payment being received. All contracts were concluded with corporate affiliates in Liechtenstein. Why Liechtenstein? Benny bared his teeth. They have strict banking secrecy laws. Uh-huh. The oligarch's brother was one of those who emigrated to Israel. His name was Akim Ugorzhilov. One fine day in 1993, he turned up at Ben-Gurion Airport with a wife and three young children in tow, claiming that he had a Jewish grandmother and had, in any case, converted to Judaism. Naturally, he had affidavits to prove all this. He has a livid scar over one eye, claims he was wounded in Afghanistan, though there is no evidence he ever served in the Soviet army. He installed himself in a heavily guarded villa in Caesarea, surrounded by a high electrified wall and staffed by Armenians who served in the army and knew how to use weapons. The Russian speakers in the Mossad called them Chelovyek Nastroyenia, moody people. One minute Akim would scream insults at the Armenians who worked for him. The next he would be purring like a cat and bragging about his business prowess. Besides the fortress in Caesarea, he had a duplex in London's Cadogan Place and a house on the Grand Corniche above Nice. How did he make ends meet in Israel? He brought in something like $50 million over the years and invested it in government bonds, which earned 6 or 7% interest, tax-free. He also has a piece of a newspaper delivery service, a hotel in Eilat, half a dozen gas stations around Haifa. Where does Samat fit into this picture? Akim and Tsvetan Ugorzhilov are brothers. It turns out there was a third brother, name of Zurab. He was a medical doctor, a member of the Armenian Communist Party and married to a Jewish woman. When Tsvetan was convicted of shaking down local merchants and sent to Siberia, his brother Zurab was arrested as an enemy of the people. Under the Soviet system, relatives of criminals usually suffered the same fate as the criminal. Zurab wound up in a Siberian gulag and died there of scarlet fever. What happened to Zurab's wife?
After the arrest of her husband, we lost all trace of her. She vanished from the face of the earth. The two brothers, Tsvetan and Zurab, had been very close, which explains, in part at least, why Tsvetan loathed the Soviet system. He blamed the communists for his brother's death. Zurab left behind him a son, named Samat, which makes Samat the oligarch's and Akim's nephew. Samat was taken under Uncle Tsvetan's wing when he returned from Siberia. The oligarch, who had no children of his own, became a surrogate father to him. In the post-Stalinist Soviet Union, and especially after Gorbachev came on the scene, the fact that Samat's father had died in Siberia counted for him instead of against him. Samat was admitted to the Elite Forestry Institute, the not-so-secret home of the Soviet space program, where he studied computer science. Later, he earned a doctorate from the State Planning Agency's Higher Economics School. His computer skills must have attracted the attention of the KGB, because the next thing we know, he was working for the 6th Chief Directorate, where he learned all there was to know about money laundering schemes and offshore banks. When the oligarch, offering Krisha and starting out in the used car business in Armenia, decided to go into the banking business to service his expanding empire, he turned to his nephew. Samat quit the KGB and opened the first bank for Tsvetan Ugorzhilov in Yerevan. And it was Samat, with a reputation of something of a genius when it came to juggling accounts and obscuring currency trails, who created the money laundering scheme under which dozens of millions of dollars were siphoned off abroad and then squirreled away in offshore banks and shell holding companies. The oligarch's holding companies are rumored to have financial interests in a Spanish insurance company, a French hotel chain, a Swiss real estate consortium, a German movie theater chain. Thanks to Samat's sleight of hand, the threads that linked these accounts were untraceable. God knows our people tried. So, for that matter, did your CIA. Samat's impenetrable labyrinth of banks stretches from France to Germany to Monaco to Liechtenstein to Switzerland to the Bahamas and the Cayman Islands, not to mention Vanuatu in the South Pacific, the Isle of Man, the British Virgin Islands, Panama, Prague, Western Samoa, all of them suspected of being involved in laundering the oligarch's considerable riches. He eventually opened bank accounts in North America, where a third of his empire's aluminum was marketed. There were shells within shells within shells. Working out of the oligarch's isolated dacha in a village half an hour from Moscow along the Moscow-Petersburg highway, Samat was constantly shifting assets from one shell to another. Wire transfers between banks, some of which consist of nothing more than a single room and a computer on some remote island, are the easiest way to move large amounts of money. $1 billion in $100 bills weighs something like 11 tons, and it was said that the oligarch's banker never committed anything to paper. The entire structure of his uncle's offshore holdings was in his head. Which was why it became urgent to get him out of Russia when the mob war heated up, Martin guessed. Precisely. We didn't figure out the connection between Samat and the second of his two uncles, Akim, until one of our teams watching Akim's villa at Caesarea caught them on film. Akim emerged from the villa and embraced Samat as he got out of his Honda, at which point we started looking into the identity of this new immigrant who had paid in cash when he bought a split-level home in Kiryat Arba. Benny offered Martin a refill, and when he shook his head no, he poured himself a short one and downed it in one gulp. It was almost as if the recounting of the story had sapped his energy. Martin said, Samat's wife mentioned that he once dropped her on the dunes in Caesarea while he went to see someone. Now I know whom he saw. Benny's potluck supper consisted of cold dishes he'd brought back in a doggy bag from an Arab restaurant in Abu Ghosh, and a bottle of red wine from the Golan. Martin, who didn't eat meat, made do with the vegetable dishes. Later, Benny broke out a bottle of 15-year-old French cognac and carefully poured some into two snifters. There was an office bash when I retired last year, he explained. This was one of my going-away presents, along with a jockstrap medal for long and loyal service. How many years? 42. Could Israel have survived without the Mossad? Martin asked. Of course, we got as much wrong as we got right. We messed up badly in 73. We told Golda Meir that the Egyptians wouldn't be ready to wage war for at least 10 years. A few weeks later, they swarmed across the Suez Canal and overran our Barlev fortresses stretched along the Israeli side of the waterway. What went wrong? Martin asked.
I suppose the same thing that went wrong in the middle and late 80s when your CIA failed to predict the breakup of the Soviet Empire and the demise of the communist system. Looking in from the outside, which is what I do these days, I can see that intelligence services are fatally flawed. They're self-tasking. They define the threats and then try to neutralize them. Threats that don't get defined slip through the mesh and suddenly turn up as full-blown disasters, at which point those who are outside the intelligence community start yapping about how we've been asleep on the job. We haven't been asleep. We've just been defining it differently. They say a camel is a horse designed by committee, Martin said. For my money, the CIA is an intelligence agency designed by the same committee. Benny shrugged. For me, Dante, it all comes down to that dead dog at the side of the road in Lebanon, the one that exploded and decapitated my son. If we had been doing the job we were paid to do, we would have anticipated the dead dog filled with PETN and identified the terrorist behind it. I have trouble. I have trouble getting past that reality. Benny climbed heavily to his feet. I think I'll turn in now, if you don't mind. The bed's made in the room next to the downstairs bathroom. Sleep well. I never sleep well, Martin murmured. He, too, was having trouble getting past the dead dog that decapitated Benny's son. I wake up in the middle of the night in a cold sweat. An ugly grin deformed Benny's lips. Occupational disease for which there is no known cure. The next morning, Benny drove Martin into Jerusalem and let him off at the bus station. One departs for Tel Aviv every 20 minutes, he said. He handed him a slip of paper. Phone number for Akim in Caesarea. It's unlisted. I'd appreciate it if you didn't tell him where you got it. I'll nose around about the phone company's magnetic tapes and let you know what I find out. By the way, Samat's not in Israel. Shabak says he flew to London 2 days before the rabbi at Kiryat Arba reported him missing. Thanks, Benny. You're welcome, Dante. I hope you find what you're looking for. I've trimmed my sails, Benny. I'm thankful for light winds. From the brick guard shack atop the high wall surrounding Akim Ugorzhilov's seaside villa in Caesarea, Martin could almost hear the hiss as the sun knifed into the western Mediterranean. Great view, Akim said, though he was standing with his back to it, sizing up his visitor, trying to figure out if his three-piece suit was custom-made or off the rack. The livid, sickle-shaped scar slashing across his high forehead over his right eye and vanishing into a long sideburn appeared to shimmer. "The Israelis think you are an Irishman named Pippin," Akim was saying, his heavy Russian accent surfacing indolently from the depths of his throat. "Then someone named Odom, which was the name on the passport you used to enter the country a week ago today, calls me from a phone booth in Tel Aviv and invites himself over to my house. Needless to say, the fact that a name is on a passport does not mean nothing. So which is it, friend, Pippin or Odom?" "The answer is complicated."
"Simplify."
Martin decided to stick close to the truth. "Pippin was a pseudonym I used years ago when I worked as a freelance explosive expert. Odom is the name I've been using since."
Akim brightened. "Pseudonyms are something I can relate to. In Soviet Russia, everybody who was anybody used them. You have heard of Vladimir Ilyich Ulyanov? He was known as Lenin, after the river Lena in Siberia. Yosef Vissarionovich Djugashvili took the alias Stalin, which meant hammer, which is how he wanted people to think of him. Lev Davidovich Bronstein escaped from prison with the help of a passport made out in the name of one of his jailers, a certain Trotsky. Me, myself, I managed to avoid being sent with my two brothers to the Gulag by adopting the identity of a sleight-of-hand magician named Melor Semyonovich Zhitkin. You are familiar with the Gulag? That's where temperatures fall below -50, and alcohol freezes, and you suck on vodka icicles carefully so they do not stick to your tongue. Using the name Melor was a stroke of genius, even if it is me who says so. Melor is a Soviet name. Stands for Marx, Engels, Lenin, Organizers of Revolution, which made the KGB think I was a diehard communist. I was diehard, all right, he added with a sinister cackle. They could not kill me, which is what made me diehard.
Without blinking one of his heavy lids or narrowing his eyes, Akeem's expression turned hard. Martin wondered how he did it. Perhaps it was the shadows playing on his face. Perhaps the pupils of his eyes had actually grown smaller. Whatever it was, the effect was chilling. Akeem's voice shed its laziness.
Pippin was an agent for the American Central Intelligence Agency who infiltrated the Hezbollah in the Bekaa Valley, posing as a freelance explosive expert with connections to the IRA. You and the CIA are said to have parted company, though I am embarrassed to say none of my sources knows why. You are startled to see how well informed I am, right? You see, in Israel, as in every civilized country, information can be purchased as easily as toothpaste. Now you claim to be a Brooklyn, New York detective named Odom. There are some who think this is simply another fabricated identity. There are others who say Odom is who you were before you were Pippin.
I did work for the CIA once. I no longer do. Odom is as close to the real me as I can get. Akeem accepted this with a wary nod.
Time for my insulin shot, he announced.
He beckoned with a pinky bearing a heavy gold ring with a diamond set into it.
Martin followed him down the narrow steps and across the lawn, past the swimming pool where three women in diaphanous dresses with low necklines were playing mahjong. He suddenly longed for the days when he investigated uncomplicated things like mahjong debts and kidnapped dogs and Chechen-run crematoriums in Little Odessa. He must have been off his rocker to think he could trace a husband who had jumped ship. Finding a needle in a haystack would be child's play compared.
Akeem reached the shaded veranda behind the mansion and motioned Martin to one of the deck chairs. Two of Akeem's Armenians, wearing sports jackets that didn't conceal the automatic pistols in their shoulder holsters, stood nearby. A male nurse dressed in a white hospital smock was squirting liquid through a needle to expel any air left in the syringe. Akeem collapsed into a deck chair and tugged the tails of his shirt out of his trousers to bare a bulging stomach. He sipped fresh orange juice through a plastic straw, as the male nurse jabbed the needle under his dry skin and injected the insulin.
Thanks a lot, Earl. See you tomorrow morning.
My pleasure, Mr. Zhitkin.
When the male nurse was out of earshot, Akeem said, As you can see, I still use the name Zhitkin from time to time. Funny how you become attached to an alias that saved your life.
At the pool, one of the women shrieked with pleasure. Akeem burst out angrily,
Keep it quiet, ladies. Don't you see I have a visitor?
Massaging the spot on his stomach where the insulin had been injected, he said,
So what do you think I can do for you, Mr. Pippin or Mr. Odom or whatever your name is today?
I really am a detective, Martin said. I was hired to find your nephew, Samat, who seems to have skipped out on his wife. I was hoping you could tell me where to start looking.
What she want, the wife? Alimony payments? A piece of his bank account? Assuming he has got a bank account, what?
I was hired by the wife's sister and father.
Who is a dead man now?
You are well informed.
They hired me to find Samat and get him to give her a divorce. She's religious. Without the divorce, she can't marry again, can't have children with another man.
Akeem tucked the tails of his shirt back into his trousers.
You have met the wife in question? He asked.
Yes.
You have seen how she dresses? Who would marry her? Who would fuck her even to have children?
She's young. She may even be a virgin. The rabbi who married her thinks she and Samat never slept together.
Akeem waved his hand in disgust.
Rabbi needs to stick to the Bible. I do not want to hear private things about my nephew. Who he fucks, whether he fucks, is not my business.
Another Armenian shouted something in a strange language from the driveway guardhouse.
Akeem said, My people want to turn on the spotlights after dark, but the neighbors complained to the police. Every time we turn them on, the police come around and order us to turn them off. What kind of a country is this where a man of means cannot light up the wall around his property? It is like as if they personally hold being rich against me.
Martin said, Maybe what they hold against you is the way you got rich.
I am starting to like you, Akeem admitted. You talk to me the way I talk to people like me when I was your age. Fact is, if I did not get rich, someone else would have got rich in my place. Making money was the only thing to do when the Soviet Union disintegrated. It was a matter of not drowning in Gorbachev's perestroika, because only the rich were able to keep their heads above water. Anyway, America brought it on, the collapse, the gangsters, the mob wars, all of it.
I'm not sure I understand what you're driving at, Martin remarked.
I am driving at history, Mr. Oldham. In 1985, the Saudi oil minister, who happened to be a big wheel in the OPEC oil cartel, announced to the world that Saudi Arabia would no longer limit production to support oil prices. You want to sit there and tell me the Americans had nothing to do with this? 8 months later, oil prices had plummeted 70%. Oil and gas exports is what kept the Soviet Union afloat for years, even for decades. The fall in oil prices started the economy downhill. Gorbachev tried to save what could be saved with his half-baked reforms, but the ship sank under his feet. When things quieted down, Russia's borders had shrunk to where they were in 1613. It is people like me and my brother who started poking through the debris and picking up the pieces. If things are better today for the masses, it is because money has been trickling down. Ha! It is an economic fact that in order for wealth to trickle down, you need to have rich people at the top to do the trickling.
If I'm reading you correctly, you are a born-again capitalist.
I am a born-again opportunist. I did not go to school like Samart. I learned what I learned in the gutter. I understand capitalism contains within itself the seeds of its own destruction. Do not smile, Mr. Oldham. The villain was your Henry Ford. By inventing the assembly line and mass-producing his cars, he lowered the price to where the assembly line workers became consumers of their own products. And with buy-now-pay-later schemes and plastic credit cards, people were able to spend money before they accumulated it. Instant gratification killed the Protestant work ethic, which glorified work and encouraged saving. Remember, you heard it here first, Mr. Oldham. America is on a slippery slope. It will not be far behind the Soviet Union in crashing.
What will be left?
We will be left. The oligarchs.
One of Akim's bodyguards came around the side of the house to the veranda. He caught Akim's eye and tapped a fingernail against the crystal on his Rolex. Akim swung his short legs off the deck chair and stood up.
I am meeting a member of the Knesset for supper in Petah Tikva, he said. Let us stop circling each other like wrestlers, Mr. Oldham. Where's our shoe leather?
Waving to the women playing mahjong, he shouted something in Armenian. Then, gesturing for Martin to accompany him, he started toward the enormous SUV parked in the driveway, exhaust streaming from its silver tailpipe.
How much they paying you to find Samat? He demanded.
I'm sorry?
Akim stopped in his tracks and eyed Martin. Once again, his face turned menacing without so much as his moving a muscle.
Are you thinking the skull or what? He said, his voice a low, lazy growl. Do I have to spill this out? Okay. I'm asking you what the wife's sister's father, who is a dead man, offered you to find my nephew Samat. I am saying that whatever he offered is nothing alongside what I will put on the table if you can lead me to him. What would you think of $1 million in cash? Or the equivalent in Swiss francs or German marks?
I don't get it.
Akim groaned in exasperation.
You do not need to get it, he insisted.
He started toward the car again.
$130 million have disappeared from six of my holding companies around the world that Samat controlled. That mouse of a wife in Kiryat Arba is not the only one who wants a divorce. Me too, I want one. I want to divorce my nephew. I want him to become my ex-nephew. So do we have an arrangement, Mr. Oldham? You have my phone number. If you get your hands on Samat before I get my hands on him, pick up the phone and give me a call and you will become a rich man. Then you will be the one to trickle down to the proletariat so they can buy more of Mr. Henry Ford's automobiles.
Stella and Martin hefted their valises onto the table and opened the locks. One of the female soldiers, wearing white surgical gloves, started to rummage through the contents. The other female soldier, her eyes black with mascara, began asking questions and ticking off items on a clipboard when she heard the answers. Had anyone given them a parcel to take out of Israel? Who had packed their valises? Had the valises been left alone after they were packed? What was the purpose of their trip to Israel? Had they been to any Arab towns or villages or the Arab sections of Jerusalem? How had they come to the airport? Had the valises been in sight all the time after they got out of the taxi? Finally, the young woman looked up. You are traveling together? Yes, Martin replied.
Excuse me for being personal, but you do not have the same family name.
We're just friends, Stella told her.
Excuse me again, but how long have you known each other?
Something like 2 weeks now, Martin said.
And you decided to come to Israel together after knowing each other only 2 weeks?
Stella bristled.
Is it written that people have to be lovers in order to travel together?
I am only asking the questions that we are instructed to put to all the passengers. She addressed Stella.
I see from your tickets that you both came to Israel from Athens. But your friend is flying to London and you are flying to New York. If you're traveling together, why are you no longer traveling together?
I'm returning to New York to bury Kastner, Stella explained.
Who is Kastner?
My father.
You call your father by his family name?
I call my father whatever I damn well decide to call him.
The young woman said, So your father is dead. She jotted something on the space reserved for comments.
I'm not planning to bury him alive, if that's what you mean.
The woman remained unfazed.
You are traveling under an American passport, but you speak English with a slight East European accent.
It's a Russian accent, actually.
I immigrated to the United States from Russia 9 years ago.
At that period, Soviet borders were not open to people who wanted to emigrate.
How did you get out of the Soviet Union?
Stella squinted at her interrogator.
My father and my sister and I went on vacation to the Black Sea in Bulgaria. The American CIA slipped us Greek passports and we joined a tour ship returning through the Bosporus to Piraeus.
The two female soldiers exchanged looks.
Airport security is not a joking matter, snapped the one searching the luggage.
There was a time in my life when I was paid for being funny, Stella retorted. This is not one of them.
The young woman with the clipboard raised a walkie-talkie to her lips and muttered something in Hebrew.
Wait here a moment, she ordered. She walked over to two men in civilian clothing and, pointing with her face at Stella and Martin, said something to them. One of the men pulled a small notebook from his pocket and thumbed through it until he came to the page he was looking for. He glanced over at Martin and then handed the female soldier an envelope. The girl shrugged. Returning to the table, she passed the envelope to Martin.
You can close your valises and check in now.
What was that all about? Stella asked Martin after they had presented their passports and boarding passes and gone up the escalator to the vast waiting room.
Martin slit open the envelope with a forefinger and unfolded the sheaf of paper in it.
Uh-huh, he muttered.
Uh-huh, what?
My old Mossad friend, the one who fed me potluck supper, says the magnetic tapes showing incoming and outgoing calls from Kiryat Arba were erased, just as the rabbi said. But they weren't erased by error. The Mossad did it as a favor for their CIA colleagues.
The plot thickens.
We knew the CIA didn't want me to find Samat. My old boss told me as much when she invited me down to the Chinese restaurant.
Martin thought about the exploding honey that had killed Min and the two bullets that a sniper had shot at him in Hebron. He led Stella to one of the rows of plastic seats out of earshot of other passengers.
How did things go with your sister after I left?
She tried to talk me into staying in Israel.
What would I do here?
Martin said, Israel is also a pressure cooker. You could always go around telling anti-Israeli jokes for a living.
Very funny. As a matter of fact, I know a good one. The rabbi told it to me. Question, what is anti-Semitism?
Answer, hating Jews more than necessary.
That's not funny, Martin said.
What's funny about it, Stella insisted angrily, is that it's not funny. I could kick myself for trying to make someone without a sense of humor laugh.
My pal Dante had a sense of humor, Martin said with a faraway look in his eyes. He left it in a room over a bar in Beirut.
Stella decided to change the subject.
Samat's uncle sounds like a real Russian mobster.
I thought he could give me an idea where to start looking for Samat. He said if he knew where to look, he wouldn't need me.
Do you think Samat really ran off with all that money? What will his uncle do if he catches up with him?
A voice over the public address system announced that the flight to London was about to start boarding. Martin climbed to his feet.
What will he do to him? I suppose he'll tickle him to death.
Stella said, You're stepping out of character and telling a joke.
Squinting, she studied Martin's face.
Okay, you're not telling a joke.
Around them, passengers were collecting their hand luggage and starting to head toward the stairs leading to the boarding gate.
I wish I were going with you. I'm getting used to your sense of humor.
I thought you said I didn't have one.
That's the part I'm getting used to.
She stood and grazed his elbow with the back of her hand.
I hope against hope you'll call me from London.
His eyes took in the triangle of pale skin on her chest. I admire your ability to hope against hope. She toyed nervously with the first button on her shirt that was buttoned.
Maybe I can infect you.
Not likely. I've been inoculated.
Inoculations wear off.
She stood on her toes and kissed him lightly on the lips.
Bye for now, Martin Odom.
Uh-huh. Bye. Crystal Quest was in Wrathful Dungeon.
There's only one thing more revolting than having to target one of your own, she declared to the Wallas scattered around her sanctum, and that's bungling the hit. Where do we hire marksmen these days? Will somebody kindly enlighten me? Coney Island popgun concessions, where you win a plastic doll if you topple the clown into the pan filled with dishwater? Oh, my God, it's pathetic. Pathetic!
We should have given the assignment to Lincoln Dittman, one of the newer Wallas suggested. I understand he's a crackerjack shot. Quest, her head angled, her eyes unblinking, gazed at the speaker as if he just might have come up with a solution to their problem.
Where did you pick up that nugget of information?
She inquired in a husky whisper, humoring the Walla before decapitating him. The young man sensed that he had ventured onto quicksand.
I was reading into the Central Registry 201 files to get a handle on our assets in the field.
His voice faltered. He looked around for a buoy, but no one seemed interested in throwing him one. Quest's mouth sagged open as her skull bobbed up and down in wonderment.
Lincoln Dittman. Now there's an idea whose time has come. Ha! Will somebody put the neophyte here out of his misery?
Quest's chief of staff, a thick-skinned time server who had weathered his share of storms in the DDO's seventh-floor bailiwick, said very evenly,
Dittman and Odom are one and the same individual, Frank. You would have seen that they were cross-referenced in the 201 files if you'd read the fine print on the first page.
That's strike one, Quest informed Frank. If you read the fine print on your employment contract, you'll see that we operate by the three strikes and you're out rule in the DDO.
She swiveled 360 degrees in her chair as if she were winding herself up.
Okay, I'll recapitulate, she said, stifling her irritation. We made an honest effort to talk Martin Odom out of walking back the cat on Samat Ugarzhilov. Martin's a consenting adult. He's doing what he has to do, and we're going to do what we have to do to make sure he never catches up to the Samat in question. This is a priority matter, which means it gets our full and undivided attention. Where did Martin Odom go when he left Israel? What leads is he following? Who is he planning to talk to? And what resources do we have on the ground? What resources can we throw into the theater of eventual operations to make sure I get to wear my sackcloth and ashes before this thing blows up in our faces?
1997. Martin Odom plays innocent. Leaning over the dead dog, Martin slit open its stomach with the blade from a safety razor, then reached in with the gloved hand to cut out the organs and create a stomach cavity. He motioned to one of the Fedayeen students, who removed the frame from the hive and gingerly set it down on the road next to the dead dog.
"Honey is very stable," Martin said with a laugh. "Tell him it won't blow up in his face until it's detonated."
Using a spatula, he carefully scraped the beeswax from the honeycombs until he had accumulated a quantity the size of a tennis ball, then wired it to the tiny homemade plastic radio receiver and slipped the package into the stomach cavity. Using a thick needle and a length of butcher cord, he sewed up the opening. Rising to his feet, he stepped back to survey his handiwork. "Any questions?" he demanded. One of the Fedayeen said something in Arabic, and the Russian with the heavy gold ring on his pinky translated it into English.
"He asks from how far away we can set off the charge."
"Depends on what equipment you're using," Martin said. "A cordless phone or a Walkman will work up to a half mile away. One of those automatic pagers that doctors wear on their belts can set off a charge 5-6 miles away. A VHF scanner or cellular mobile phone is effective for 10 or 12 miles, as long as the weather is good and there is no frequency jamming." Martin, trailed by his three students and the translator, set off up the slope and went to ground behind the rusty wreck of a UN jeep. They didn't have long to wait. The Israeli patrol, led by a soldier scanning the dirt road with a magnetic mine detector, appeared around the bend. The soldier searching for mines passed his metal detector over the dog and, getting no reading, continued on. The officer behind him came abreast of the dog. Something must have caught his eye, the crude stitches on the stomach probably, because he crouched next to the animal to have a closer look. Martin nodded at the Fedayeen holding the automatic pager that had been rigged to transmit a signal to the plastic receiver inside the dog's stomach. Below, a dull blast stirred up a fume of mustard-colored smoke. When it cleared, the Israeli officer was still crouching next to the dog, but his head could be seen rolling slowly toward the shoulder of the road.
"Comes as news to me that honey can explode," the Russian whispered, his thick Slavic accent surfacing indolently from the depths of his throat.
The sulfurous stench of the burnt beeswax reached Martin's nostrils, and he had trouble breathing. Gasping for air, he bolted upright in bed and blotted the cold sweat from his brow with a corner of the sheet. His heart was beating furiously. A migraine was pressing against the back of his eyeballs. For a terrible moment, he didn't know who he was or where he was. He solved the second problem first when he heard the hacking cough of the old man 2 rooms down the corridor of the boarding house and knew where he wasn't, southern Lebanon. When he figured out which legend he was inhabiting, his breathing gradually returned to normal. When his plane landed at Heathrow 4 days before, Martin had breezed through passport control without a hitch.
"Here on business or pleasure, is it?" the woman's custom agent in the booth had asked.
"With any luck, pleasure in the form of licensed tabernacles and museums, and in that order," he'd answered. The woman had flashed a jaded smile as she stamped him into the country.
"If it's pubs you're looking for, you've come to the right corner of the world. Enjoy your stay in England."
Collecting his valise from the baggage carousel, Martin had started following the signs marked underground when a portly young man with a peaches and cream complexion had materialized in front of him.
"Mr. Odom, is it?" he'd asked.
"How come you know my name?" The young man, his body wrapped in a belted trench coat a size too large for him, had ignored Martin's question.
"Could I trouble you to come with me, sir?" he had said.
"Do I have a choice?"
"I'm afraid you don't."
"What are you, 5 or 6?
M15, thank you kindly. 6 thinks you're radioactive. Wouldn't touch you with a 10-foot pole.
Martin could see 3 other men in trench coats closing in on him, so he turned and limped behind the young man across the arrival hall and up a flight of steps to a balcony overlooking the hall. Peaches and Cream stopped before an opaque glass door with the word "perishables" stenciled on it. He rapped on the glass twice with his knuckles and opened the door and politely stepped aside. Inside, a middle-aged woman dressed in a man's pinstriped suit and tie was busy calling up file folders on a computer terminal. Without looking up, she inclined her head towards an inner door with the words "Supervisor, Perishables" stenciled on the glass. In the inner office, Martin discovered a black man with a shaven head studying the baggage carousels below through the slats of a partly closed Venetian blind. The black man swiveled around in his seat and sank back into it.
"I'll admit it, you don't look like your average serial killer to me," he said in a soft purr.
"What does an average serial killer look like?"
"Glassy stare as he avoids your eye, bitten fingernails, mouth drooping open, saliva drooling down the stubble of his chin. Bela Lugosi sort of role."
"Are you a cop or a movie critic?"
Snickering at Martin's question, the supervisor, Perishables, began reading from a yellowing index card.
"Last trace we had on you, you were a bloke with 2 incarnations. In the first, you were Pippin, Dante, an Irishman who declined to help us with our inquiries after the IRA blew open a bus in central London. In the second, you were Ditman, Lincoln, an American arms merchant peddling his wares to the highest bidder in the triple border area of Latin America."
Martin said, "Case of mistaken identity. You're confusing me with the anti-heroes of B-films."
"Don't think we are," the supervisor, Perishables, allowed.
He arched his brows and took a long look at Martin, who was shifting his weight from one foot to the other.
"If we had chairs, I'd invite you to rest your arse on one of them. Sorry about that."
"Been sitting from Tel Aviv to here," Martin said. "Glad to stretch my legs."
"Yes, well, in Israel you were passing yourself off as Martin Odom, a ruck of a private detective working out of the New York borough of..."
He checked his file card.
"Brooklyn. That's quite inventive, actually. Some nonsense about hunting for a missing husband so his wife could get a religious divorce. It goes without saying, knowing your track record, neither our antenna in Israel nor our Perishables division here in London swallowed the cover story. So what are you hawking around this time, Mr. Ditman? Used one-owner Kalashnikovs? That Ukrainian-manufactured passive radar system they say can detect stealth aircraft at 500 miles distance? Nerve gas masquerading as talcum powder? Seed stock for biological agents that cause cholera or camel pox?"
"None of the above,"
Martin smiled innocently. "Search me."
"Don't mind if I do."
He touched a button on a console. Martin could hear a buzzer wheeze in the outer office. The young man with the peaches and cream complexion and the woman who had been working on the computer terminal entered the room. "Would you be so kind as to give us the key to your valise, Mr. Dittman?" the woman asked, "and then disrobe." The black man came around the desk. Martin could see he was the kind who worked out at a gym often enough to hope the man who was supposed to help the police with their inquiries would resist. Martin glanced at the woman. "I'm the timid type," he remarked.
"Nothing you have, Governor, she hasn't seen," snapped Peaches and Cream in a mock Cockney accent.
The two men concentrated on Martin, stripping him to the skin and going over every square inch of his three-piece suit and underwear and socks. The supervisor Perishables paid particular attention to his shoes, inserting them one at a time into a contraption that projected an X-ray image of the shoe onto a glass plate. The woman emptied the contents of the valise onto the desk and began examining each item. The search was nothing if not meticulous. Toothpaste was squeezed out of its tube into a plastic container that had Chinese writing on the side. Cold capsules were split open and inspected. The small container of shaving cream was emptied and then cut in half with a hacksaw. Standing in the middle of the room, stark naked, Martin tried to imagine the anti-British joke that Stella would concoct out of the episode, but he couldn't come up with a punchline. Stella was surely right when she said he didn't have a sense of humor. "I suppose you're going to compensate me for property destroyed," he ventured as he started to pull on his clothing. The supervisor, Perishables, took the question seriously.
"You go ahead and replace the items in question and send us the bill," he said. "If you address it to Heathrow, Perishables, it should get here, shouldn't it, lads and ladies? Everyone knows who we are. Mind if I ask how long you reckon on staying in the country, Mr. Dittman?"
"No, ask." Supervisor Perishables didn't crack a smile.
"How long you reckon on staying in the country, Mr. Dittman?"
"My name is Odom, Martin Odom. I'm in Britain to tell anti-English jokes that will spread across the country like wildfire and take people's minds off the drudgery of day-to-day life. I plan to stay as long as folks keep laughing."
"He's certainly original," the black man told his associates.
Peaches and Cream accompanied Martin down to the arrival hall.
"No hurt feelings, I hope, Governor," he said, falling back into his phony Cockney accent and trying to sound ironic.
Following the signs leading to the underground, Martin quickly spotted the two men who were following him, one about 15 paces behind, the other 10 paces behind the first. What gave them away was their habit of concentrating on the windows of the boutiques every time he turned in their direction. As Martin reached the escalator down to the train level, the first man peeled away, the second closed the gap, and a third hove into view behind him. The resources they were devoting to keep track of Lincoln Dittman made Martin feel important. It had been a long time since anyone thought he was interesting enough to lay on a staggered tail. As always in situations like this, Martin was more preoccupied with the agents he didn't see than the ones he was meant to spot. He took the Piccadilly line to Piccadilly Circus and the escalator to the street, then leaned against the side of a kiosk to give his game leg a rest. After a while, he strolled toward Tottenham Court Road, stopping at a chemist's shop to buy toothpaste and shaving cream, eventually at a pub with a neon sign sizzling over the door that brought back memories of the Beirut waterfront and Dante's Alawite prostitute named Jamila. He settled onto a stool at the dimly lit end of the bar and sipped at his half-pint of lager until half of it was down the hatch. Opening his valise, he slipped the packet of false identity papers into the white silk bandana, then mopped his brow with it and stuffed it into the pocket of his suit jacket. Hefting his small valise onto the bar, folding his Burberry across it, he asked the bartender to keep an eye on his things while he used the loo in the back. Martin didn't even bother checking the tails, two outside in the street, one at a corner table in the front of the pub. They were all young, and young meant green, so they would fall for the oldest trick on the books. They would keep their eyes glued to the half-consumed glass of lager and the valise with the raincoat on it, and wait for him to return. Depending on their relationship with the supervisor Perishables, they might or might not report that Martin had gone missing when he failed to come back. Martin remembered this particular men's lavatory from a stint in London a lifetime ago. He'd been on his way to the Soviet Union and stopped off for a briefing from M16's East European desk. What cover had he been using then? It must have been the original Martin Odom legend, because Dittman and Pippin came later, or so it seemed to him. In a remote corner of a lobe of his brain, he had filed away one of those tradecraft details that field hands collected as if they were rare stamps. This particular lavatory had a fire door that was locked, but could be opened in an emergency by breaking a glass and removing the key hanging on a hook behind it. To Martin's way of thinking, this clearly qualified as an emergency. He found the glass and retrieved the key and opened the fire door. Moments later, he found himself in a narrow passage that gave onto a side street and, as luck would have it, a taxi stand. "Paddington," he told the driver. He changed taxis twice more and only gave his real destination to the final driver. "Golders Green," he said, settling into the back seat and enjoying his fleeting triumph over the warm bodies from Five.
"Any particular place on Golders Green?" the driver asked over the intercom.
"You can let me off near the clock at the top. I'll walk from there."
"Right you are, Governor. You American, are you?"
"What makes you think that?"
"It's the accent, Governor. I know American when I hear it."
"Actually, I'm Polish," Martin had said, "but I've lived in America and it rubbed off."
The driver had tittered into the microphone.
"I can tell someone what's pulling my leg, Governor. If you're Polish, that makes me an Eskimo."
Martin had paid off the taxi in front of the Golders Green Underground Station. Standing under the word Courage engraved in the stone monument at the top of Golders Green, he took his bearings, then set off down the broad avenue awash in sunlight and filled with midday pedestrians. Filipino maids pushing old ladies tucked into wheelchairs, teenaged boys in embroidered skullcaps careening past on mountain bikes, dozens of ultra-religious women wearing wigs and long dresses, window shopping in front of stores with signs in English and Hebrew. Martin found a second-hand store run by a Jewish charity and bought himself an old valise that looked as if it had been around the world several times. He made a slit in the frayed silk lining under the lid and hid his stash of documents, then filled the valise with threadbare but serviceable clothing. He came across a second-hand aqua scutum that they were practically giving away because the belt was missing and the hem was in tatters. At a chemist's, he bought more toothpaste and a disposable razor and a small tube of shaving cream. On Woodstock Avenue, off Golders Green, he spotted a ramshackled house next to a synagogue with a sign on the unkempt lawn advertising rooms for rent. He paid the grumpy landlady for a week in advance, stored his gear, and went around the corner for a bite to eat at a kosher delicatessen across the street from a church. Mid-afternoon, he walked up Golders Green to the Chinese Medicinal Center for a session of acupuncture on his game leg. When he complained that his leg felt sorer after the acupuncture, the old Chinese man, plucking the long needles deftly out of Martin's skin, said it was well known that things had to get worse before they could get better. Leaving a 10-pound note on the counter, Martin promised he would bear that in mind. Starting back toward the rooming house, he noticed he was able to walk with less pain than before. He wondered whether it was due to the acupuncture needles or the power of suggestion. He bought a phone card at a tobacco shop and ducked into a fire engine red booth on the corner of Woodstock and Golders Green that had a burnt phone book dangling from a chain. He rummaged in his wallet for the scrap of paper with the phone number that Yelena had found on the back of the strudel recipe and, inserting his plastic card, dialed it. Martin retrieved Tante Pippin's rusty Irish accent for the occasion.
"And who would I be speaking to, then?" he inquired when a female voice came on the line. "Mrs. Rainfield, dear."
"Good morning to you, Mrs. Rainfield. This is Patrick O'Fallon from the phone company. I'm up on a pole on Golders Green trying to sort out your lines. Could you do me the favor of pressing the number 5 and the number 7 on your phone in that order?"
"5, then 7.
"That's the ticket, Mrs. Rainfield."
"Did you hear it?"
"Loud and clear. Do it once more to be sure, will you now?"
"Okay."
"Beautiful. We ought to be hiring the likes of you.
Will you tell me what's going on?"
"Don't ask me how, but your cable seems to have gotten itself twined around your neighbor's lines. One of them complained she heard crosstalk when she tried to use her phone. Did you experience any static on yours, Mrs. Rainfield?"
"Now that you mention it, the phone did seem fuzzier than usual this morning."
"You ought to be hearing me clear as a bell now."
"I am, thank you."
"We spend most of our time climbing up phone poles to fix things that aren't broken. Now and then it's gratifying to fix something that is. You get half the credit. It was child's play once you hit the 5 and the 7. For my worksheet, I'll be needing your full name and an address to go with your phone."
"I'm Doris Rainfield," the woman said, and she gave an address on North End Road, a continuation of Golders Green, behind the railroad station.
"Thanks, Emil."
"Ta."
Martin pressed the buzzer next to the enormous steel door with "Soft Shoulder" engraved on a brass plaque and looked up into the security camera. There was a burst of static over the intercom. A woman's nasal voice surfed above the static.
"If you're delivering, you need to go round to the loading dock in back."
"Mr. Martin Odom," Martin called, "come to see the director of Soft Shoulder."
"Are you the bloke what's shipping the prostheses to Bosnia?"
"Afraid not. I was sent by a friend of the director's, a Mr. Samat Ugarzilov."
"Wait a minute, love."
The static gave way to an eerie quiet. A moment later, the woman whom Martin took for Mrs. Rainfield came back on the intercom.
"Mr. Rabani, he wants to know how you know Mr. Ugarzilov."
Tell him, Martin said, employing the phrase Kastner had used the day they met on President Street, we're birds of a feather.
Come again?
Yes, well, you can tell Mr. Rabbani that I know somewhat from Israel. There was another interval of silence. Then a discreet electric current reached the lock in the door and it clicked open the width of a finger. Martin pushed it wide open and strode into the warehouse. He heard the door click closed behind him as he headed down the cement passageway lined with calendars from the 1980s, each with a photograph of a spread-eagled movie starlet flirting with nakedness. In the glass-enclosed cubicle at the end of the passageway, a young woman with pointed breasts and short hair the color and texture of straw sat behind a desk, painting her fingernails fuchsia. Martin poked his head through the open door.
You will be Doris Rainfield, he guessed.
The woman looked up, intrigued.
Samat went and told you about me, did he, dear?
She batted the fingers of her right hand in the air to dry the nail polish.
I like Samat, I do. Oh, he's one for putting on airs, waltzing in with that top coat of his flung over his shoulders like it was some kind of cape or other. He looked like the Sheik in one of them Rudy Valentino silent period pictures, if you get my drift.
I do get your drift, Mrs. Rainfield. The woman lowered her voice to share a confidence.
Truth is, I'm not Mrs. Rainfield. I used to be Mrs. Rainfield, but I got myself legally hitched 6 weeks and 3 days back to Nigel Froth, which makes me Mrs. Froth, doesn't it, dear? Do you recognize the name? My Nigel's a world-class snooker player. Made the quarterfinals of the UK Snooker Championship last year. Lost to the bloke who came in second, he did, which was a feather in his cap. I'm referring to Nigel's cap, not the bloke who came in second's cap. I still use my first husband's name at the office because that's what Mr. Rabbani calls me. All the paperwork here is in the name of Rainfield, and he says it'd be a bloody pain in the you-know-what to switch over.
Martin leaned against the door jamb. Does Mrs. Rainfield act any differently than Mrs. Froth?
I suppose she does, now that you mention it. My Mr. Froth fancies me in miniskirts and tight sweaters, he does. Mr. Rainfield wouldn't have let me out of me house dressed like this. It's a lot like Samat's cape, isn't it, dear? What you wear is who you want to be.
Fluttering unnaturally long lashes, Mrs. Rainfield pointed out the door at the bitter end of the passageway with her eyes.
Through there, then cross the warehouse on a diagonal, and you'll fall on Mr. Rabbani's bailiwick. His factotum, an Egyptian named Rashid, trust me, you won't miss him, minds the door.
Is Rashid his real name, or is it a matter of Mr. Rabbani not wanting to redo the paperwork? Mrs. Rainfield giggled appreciatively. Martin said, thank you, and started down the corridors created by stacks of cartons, all of them stenciled with the word prosthesis and arm or leg, and a measurement in inches and centimeters, along with a notation in smaller print that the articles had been manufactured in the United States of America. Above Martin's head, diffused sunlight streamed through skylights stained with soot and bird droppings. A heavy-set man with unshaven jowls and untidy hair, clearly the bodyguard, loomed beyond the last cartons. A handwritten name tag pinned to the wide lapel of his double-breasted suit jacket identified him as Rashid. "You carrying?" he inquired, sizing Martin up with eyes that conveyed indifference to the visitor's fate in the unlikely event he resisted inspection. Martin played a role he wasn't accustomed to. Innocent.
Carrying what?
Weapon of any kind, Rashid snapped. Something the municipal police might mistake for a handgun.
Grinning, Martin spread his legs apart and raised his arms. The bodyguard frisked him very professionally, passing his hand so high up the crotch that he grazed his penis with his knuckles, causing Martin to shudder.
You ticklish, then? The bodyguard remarked with a smirk.
He inclined his head in the direction of a door with a neatly lettered plastic placard on it that said, Talatbek Rabbani, Export. Martin knocked. After a moment, he knocked again and heard the scratchy voice of an old man call out weakly,
So what are you waiting on, my son? A hand-delivered invite?
End of Disc 4. Please continue with the next disc.